introduce our main speaker for this evening, America from San Diego.
Hi, everybody. My name's America. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for asking me to come out. And let's see. Welcome to the newcomers. Happy birthday. Anything else I missed? All right. I never plan what I'm going to say, so I may be all over the place. I was told that I'm supposed to share from the gut, and if I'm worried about how I sound or what I'm saying, then that's about ego. So however it comes out is however it's going to come out. So my sobriety date is July 15th, 1991. I rolled into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 3 weeks after my 19th birthday, and at that point, I had already spent half of my life in addiction. And so I was ready, really, 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 really ready to be sober when I got here. Life was not working at all. I'll give you sort of a brief summary of my upbringing, just to give you just sort of an idea. I grew up here in town, and I grew up in North County. I have a sister, Tiffany, and she's older than me. And also, sadly, in September, she died of this disease. And so, you know, it would have been really easy for my head to go and tell me things like, now you're an only child. I'm not an only child. I had a sister growing up. You know, it'd be really easy for my head to tell me, you know, this is too much for you. You can't handle this. Well, actually, if God doesn't give me more than I can handle, then it's not too much for me. And, you know, if I want to sit in my pity pot and sit and miss her, and there's nothing wrong with missing her, but what I choose to do instead is reflect on what a great sister she was to me, that she's certainly not suffering. I mean, because, you know, when I was out there, I was really in a lot of pain. But the pain that she got into dwarfs mine. And the idea that she doesn't suffer anymore is actually pretty spectacular, in my opinion. And I'm grateful for that. But my sister and I grew up, my parents are still married, you know, my family is normie-ish, there's some isms that go on there, but, you know, I think when I was real young, we didn't have any money, and then my dad started to do well when I was in and around third grade, and things started to get better, and we started living in better houses and driving better cars and all that kind of stuff. And the only reason why that's significant is because it got me to really focus on the outside. Tell them I'm busy, if you would. And focusing on all the things on the outside. And, you know, and that created a pattern for me of always trying to find something out there to make this hole in my gut feel better, and it never did. And, you know, I struggled socially when I was in elementary school. You know, my name's America. You know, I was the smartest kid in class. You know, I was the first kid with braces. I had glasses. You know, any reason that you could go after a kid, they went after me for. It's like, ooh, let's, you know, hit the girl in the face with, you know, with the dodgeball. You know, it's like, yeah, you're so great. You know, I'm like blind in one eye. You're such an athlete to be able to do that. And I was just, and at that time in my life, I will tell you that the disease thinking was huge, because it was a lot of self-pity, a tremendous amount of fear. I had so much fear because I just didn't want people to go after me. You know, and they always would go after me given an opportunity. And so I was always just sort of looking around and, you know, I have this, several memories of this, but where when I was in school, my sister was 2 years ahead of me. And so I would eat lunch and then I would go and sit in line And I wouldn't play with the other kids because they would just be mean to me. And so somehow there was this sense of pride of being able to be first in line. So I was always first in line. And I would sit there and I would get really sad and I would start crying. And my sister could see me out of her classroom because we had staggered lunches. And she would sneak out of her classroom and she would come and sit with me while I cried. And she would hug me and tell me everything was going to be better and that she loved me and that everything was okay. And, you know, and that was the kind of relationship I had with my sister. I mean, I can count on one hand how many times we ever got in a big fight. And because my mom always said, you know, friends will come and go, sisters are forever, you know. And I really, you know, had that, really a tremendous gift to have that with my sister. And she was always my protector. And there was a lot of focus on weight, food, all kinds of really obsessiveness in my household. And that was actually where my first disease came from and ultimately was hospitalized for bulimia when I was 17. And I was really ready. I mean, at that point, I already spent 7 years of active addiction there. But the issue was that when I went into treatment, I was not given a spiritual solution to my problem. And I cross-addicted in a hot second. And, I mean, I started drinking, you know, by the time I got sober, I was, drinking a gallon of vodka every 2.5 days and coming out of blackouts, driving my boss's car, you know, just utter insanity. I drank every day. I mean, my last drunk, I came out of a blackout on the 94 next to the drunk bumps, near the center divide, you know, and I had a case of beer. I have no idea how I acquired it because I certainly didn't have a fake ID. And I was going over to these guys' house that I was hanging out, these Navy guys, because candidly, they were the only guys that could drink like me. Nobody could drink like me. Everybody was done. I mean, we used to go down to Mexico all the time, and I drove because I was the only one standing. And, you know, and the way that I would drink when I would go down there was I would order 12 shots of tequila and 6 beers. That was my first order. And I didn't know that that was binge drinking when I went into college. You know, I had a 0.3 blood alcohol level, a little alcoholic overdose. It was a shot contest with a linebacker that I won. And still pride in that, even though that's sort of sick and alcoholic. But, you know, it is my badge of honor. And so it was really ugly for me. And, you know, I was really, 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 really fortunate. And thank you for the 10-minute speaker. You know, I had parents that I was somehow managed to closet my drinking because I was so afraid of judgment, particularly from my father, because in my eyes, I could never be enough for him. And so I never wanted to disappoint him. And what I learned ultimately was that we can't transmit something that we haven't got, which means you're going to transmit what you have. And so if you're a parent and you can't even be nice to yourself and say loving, kind things to you, how can you possibly say it to your children? And that took a lot of work in AA to kind of to get to that. But what happened was I got pulled out of school because of my spectacular performance at Arizona State. And and I was sort of like on double secret probation, and I was going to community college. And I just started drinking again. Like, things started to calm down. And there was such a profound change in my attitude, and my parents had no idea that I was drinking. And but when my attitude got so bad, my parents just threw me out of the house. Like, you're gone. You can't take your car, nothing. And you're on your own. And it took very short time for me to burn through all of my friends and end up, literally, had I not gotten this job as a live-in nanny slash maid, I would have been homeless because I burned through everybody and I was 19 years old. And man, it was bleak, really, really, really bleak. There were times, certainly, that it was fun, but it was really ugly. And when I came, when I my first meeting was at, I was sharing with this before the meeting, was at a big book study. And I remember walking in, and I'm sitting there, and of course they always know you're new. I don't know how they know. I mean, other than it was like the vodka pouring out of my pores, you know. But there was about 20 people in there, and they were asking for newcomers. And this lady says to me, well, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, you don't have to say you're an alcoholic. And without missing a beat, I was like, what are you, sniffing glue? Of course I am. My name's America. I'm an alcoholic. I burst into tears, you know. And and after that meeting, unbeknownst to me at the time, they were passing a big book around, and everybody was writing their name and their number in it. And at the end of the meeting, they gave it to me, and they said, call anyone in this book, and we'll take you to a meeting tomorrow. And that's exactly what I did. And my next meeting was a 12 and 12. And then I went to my third meeting. It's just so clear to me. There was a woman there that looked like a kindergarten teacher or something. And she was taking 8 years of sobriety. And I was like, what? This lady, no way this lady drank like I did. And then she opened her mouth and started sharing. I'm like, whoa, man. You're awesome. And and then my fourth meeting was a young people's meeting, which was integral for that time in my life. And there was a whole kind of, it was in Poway, and there was a lot of young people there. And I would say that there were generally about 70 people, young people, in this young people's meeting every Thursday. And of those 12 people, there's probably 8 of us that are still sober. Now, not that people haven't come back and gotten sober again, but have maintained continuous sobriety. And I was fortunate enough that I had some old-timers that were around me. This man named Cactus Jack. And he was like 150 years old, looked like Santa Claus, like had 30-plus years of sobriety. And I ended up renting a room at his house. Like, he had basically had sober living before sober living was like the thing to have. And this man was so instrumental in my recovery, and probably, you know, one of the big things that he taught me was how to pray. And because I had such an issue with the higher power concept when I got here, because I was brought up with that thing that, you know, that religion is a crutch for weak people. And I did not understand the difference between spirituality and religion. And some people can have religion for them, but that's not my experience. And he said, I was upset about something, and he's like, you need to pray about it. And I was like, I'm going to try not to swear a lot as I go through this, but I can only just say that when I would pray, I felt like a complete asshole, like a fraud. Like, there was no other way. I felt like such a liar, and that almost that, like, if anything was looking down at me, it was like, I'm going to condemn you because I know you are lying. And I was so broken and distant from a relationship with a higher power. And he said, well, Cactus Jack, he's like, wow, you know, because he was really old. And he'd say, well, if you had a problem and you were driving in your car and your best friend was sitting in the car, what would you be doing? Well, I would be telling her everything that's going on, and what's everything doing? He goes, and then what would you do? Well, I would listen to what she has to say. He goes, that's how you pray. You just talk to God like you're talking to your best friend. And then you just sit and listen and see if anything comes. But if you're willing to have the information come, the information will come. And that's been my experience. And I want to read a couple of things out of the big book because it's really integral to my recovery. You know, I really thought when I got here that the issue that I had was that I just liked to party. Like, I really did not get this concept of, you know, phenomenon of craving and all of that. And so I'm going to read this out of the doctor's opinion. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is interest, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And so this is the cycle of addiction, right? So they are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks they see others taking with impunity, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging always remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And this is repeated over and over again. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. And it says in the spiritual experience in book that our spiritual experience is a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. And what is that? Because, you know, here's the thing that I really love about this program, because they don't just say, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink, because that doesn't work. What they say instead is you need to go to meetings, you need to have service commitments, you need to work the steps. And that's ultimately what the triangle is, right? You know, the triangle with the circle. And the way that it was taught to me is that first and foremost, it's an equilateral triangle, meaning all sides of the triangle are the same. So the amount of meetings that you go to, unity, service, the amount of service work, and the amount of recovery that you do should be equal. And so what they said is if you're standing on the tip top of this triangle, and if you're only going to meetings and you have service commitments, but you're not working the steps, you're going to fall. If you're going to meetings, you're working the steps, but you don't have service commitments, you're going to fall. And what I can tell you definitively, I would not be standing here today if I did not sponsor women. It has, and the reason that's such a big deal is, I'll read this other part because this is the stuff that I like to cover when I'm up here. It's about this guy. Let me find it. Page 35. Okay. Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answers we had found. He made a beginning. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he'd lost through drinking. And here's the really important part. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. And so, what you know, one of the things that I really have tried to do is that I get that we all have the OCD to some extent. You know what I mean? And if we're here, we have a little bit of that OCD more than the average people and walking around in the world. And so I have tried to use my OCD for good instead of evil. So instead of like obsessing on something negative, I obsess on finding a solution. And the other thing that I sort of started focusing my energy on was finding patterns. And one of the things that it said here was that he was drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession because he failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life. So the question I asked then was, well, how the heck am I supposed to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life? Well, it tells us right here in Bill's story. It said, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. Here's the, pay attention here. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. And so if I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, if the way that I build my spiritual condition is through work and self-sacrifice for others, that's how I stay sober. And so, you know, one of the things that Cactus Jack told me is that, you know, around service, if it's not inconvenient, it's not service. And it's like, oh, no, I don't want to go on a Saturday afternoon and read the book. Yes, I will. I'll do it and like it, you know. And because the only thing I can control is my attitude. And, you know, and that's something because, you know, getting sober as young as I did, I mean, I walked in, you know, to AA, and to my perception, and there were a lot less young people in the rooms at that time. I mean, they had that young people's meeting, but you'd go to other meetings other than young people's meetings, and I swear to God, I thought my life was over. I'm like, everybody is old, and I'm never going to be able to have fun again. And, you know, I was told that, you know, the biggest partiers of all the partiers in the history of the universe live here. If anybody knows how to have fun, it's these people, and that I just struck the lottery if I want to have fun. And that has sure been the case, and getting involved and going to campouts and dances and all the different things that, you know, I sort of thought was kind of cheesy, but as soon as I started doing it, I was really having a lot of fun. And, you know, one of the things that I can tell you is, you know, I went to the dentist last week, and the dentist said to me, you know, you always have this real kind of calmness and serenity about you. And I was like, really? And I mean, the fact that someone noticed it so much, he goes, because I had been there previously when my sister had died. He goes, and even when you went through all that stuff with your sister, he goes, I was amazed. He goes, I'm really amazed with you. And I was like, wow. And that didn't come just because I was going to meetings and working the steps. You know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. The only requirement for long-term sobriety is working the steps and living the triangle. And so, you know, you can either be someone that hangs on the fringes, or you can be someone that's right in the center and doing the work. And it pays off. I mean, I had a total person just completely out of nowhere give me, that's quite a spectacular compliment for someone like me, that, you know, the kind of crazy that used to go through my head. And what I realize is, you know, I'll tell you, one of the things I think that sobriety is about is like when a little kid, when they're running around and they first stub their toe, they're like rolling around in pain. Like, oh my God, this is the worst pain ever. They're screaming and crying or whatever. Now, as an adult, if we stub our toe, it's like, oh, damn it. Has the pain gotten any less? Or has my ability to deal with physical pain improved? And it's choice B. And so what sobriety is, particularly early sobriety, is a series of emotional toe stubbings. And it's just learning how to, like, process through it. And, you know, one of the things that really kind of jumped out at me was when they said, you know, you have to abandon your old ideas completely. And, you know, I had just sort of this catastrophic thinking all the time and extremely narcissistic, self-serving, self-centered, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my troubles. And what happened was when I had... I think I had about 5 years of sobriety, and I had been trying to quit smoking for about a year, and I'd quit, and then I'd start, and I'd quit, and I stayed quit one time for 10 months, and then I smoked a clove, and then I smoked another clove, and then I bought a pack of cigarettes, and then I smoked again, you know, and I went through this whole thing, and one day I woke up, and I was just, like, so done with smoking, but what I said this time, for whatever reason, was that I said, today I am a non-smoker. Because what I learned is that what we do here is that whatever we focus on is what we get. Like, if we were meant to focus on the problem, the chapter in the book would be called There Is a Problem. You know, it's called There Is a Solution. So, and I have to tell you, I haven't smoked in 15 years. And, because I'm a non-smoker. And what kind of started happening for me was that I would realize that I would have, you know, situations go on during the day, and I would say, God, please remove my fear. Please remove my fear. And then all of a sudden, I was like, I just need to start saying, I have faith. Like, I have faith. I am safe and protected. God never gives me more than I can handle, even if it feels like it. Doesn't matter if it feels like it. I'm never given more than I can handle. And if I don't bitch and complain when everything is going great, I don't bitch and complain when things don't go my way. You know, God is either everything or God is nothing. And God is everything for me. And I'll tell you, the last 18 months of my sobriety, I've dealt with divorce, pending bankruptcy, my sister died, I had a major change. I have MS, and I had a pretty significant change in my status with my MS. And on paper, this should be the worst time in my life by a long shot. And I can tell you definitively, the first 2-3 years I was sober was way harder. Way harder. That's because it's all the toe stubbings. I had to learn, like, oh, okay, you know. And now I just know that I'm safe and protected. And, you know, one of the things that I'm watching my time over here, even though I have a timekeeper, so. One of the things, you know, the God is everything, God is nothing thing. You know, when I had 10 years of sobriety, I almost died, like literally, like talking like in a coma for 6 days, kind of die. And it was a doctor that gave me wrong medicine and it became toxic in my system. And I literally nearly died, and it completely changed, like, the trajectory of my life. And when I came, I was in this coma, and I came out of the coma, and I had brain damage. I was walking with a walker. It was really a significant life event. I couldn't work for several years, trying to get my brain working again. I, you know, start talking and lose my train of thought every, you know, 45 seconds. And I had also, you know, I've sort of always had health issues. And one of the things that I had since I was 13 is I had fibromyalgia, and it kept getting worse. And it had progressed to the point when I was probably about 23 that I was actually given handicap parking and was offered a morphine pump. I was like, yeah, I'm just going to have to be a bitch and not deal with that because I can't do that for the long term. You know what I mean? It's like one thing if you're out of surgery or something, but doing that for me, I just didn't see that as something that was going to work for me. And it was, this was, you know, pretty major. And I decided after things started coming together after a couple of years, I decided to move up to Los Angeles. And because when you almost die, like one of the things I always said was, I've lived in San Diego my whole life. Maybe I ought to try someplace new. And, you know, the climate's decent in L.A., and I knew some people up there. So I thought I'd try moving to a new city, and that's exactly what I did. And when I was up there, I came across this doctor that combined Western and Eastern medicine. And treated my fibromyalgia for about 6 months, and then I was free of pain. For the first time in 20 years, free of pain. And I was dealing with a lawsuit with this doctor. And so I came back down to San Diego, and I went on a bike ride with one of my girlfriends that's in the program. And we went from Shelter Island, all, you know, Point Loma, all the way, you know, around the Embarcadero, took the ferry over with our bikes, had lunch in Coronado, rode down the Silver Strand, came back. I mean, it was like the most beautiful day. It wasn't too hot, perfect breeze, great for riding your bike. And all of a sudden, this thought occurred to me as I'm looking around, and I thought, had this doctor not almost killed me, I would not have ended up moving to Los Angeles. Had I not moved to Los Angeles, I never would have found this doctor that cured me of my pain. And had I not been cured of my pain, I never would have been able to go on this bike ride. There would have been no way I could have done anything like that. And so the worst thing that ever happened in my life ended up being the best thing that ever happened in my life. So that tells you that I don't always know what's best. And so what I did start to do from that point when I... Because I always ask God, you know, God, show me what I need to see here. Show me what I need to see here because I want to learn the lessons. Sometimes I get the answers, but in this particular case, it took like 5 years for me to get this level of clarity on this. And I was, I realized that I had to really start seeking that information and really start challenging the things in my head because, you know, I did have, you know, a fair amount of kind of victim tendency in my thinking when I was going around with, the, you know, this stuff with this doctor because it was like major, you know. And in fact, I remember when I was going into court getting ready to do this with this doctor, I was all of a sudden hit with just like this wave of like, holy shit, because I hadn't seen this guy, you know, and, you know, this guy almost killed me. I mean, if he wasn't a doctor, this would have been the guy that like attempted murder, you know what I mean? But he was the doctor, so it's malpractice. And I called my sponsor and I'm freaking out. And she says, what's going on? And I said, I'm freaking out. I have to see this guy. This guy almost killed me. And she goes, well, what I'm going to tell you is going to be a lot easier than actually doing what is going to have to happen here. But what you have to remember is that everything in this world is forgivable. It doesn't make it right, but it is forgivable. And I said, but I can't seem to get past the fear and the anger. Even though I had done inventory work and all kinds of stuff, it just came to me, you know. And so she goes, well, here's what I want you to do. She goes, I want you to imagine for a moment what it must be like to be this doctor right now. Imagine his career is hanging in the balance. And he has, my mother had the foresight to go in and get my medical records. He subsequently doctored them, and so I had copies of records that were actually correct. So she had said, you know, this guy is even willing to lie and doctor records so that, that his ass is covered. He's so afraid right now. Can you even imagine for a second what it must be like to have that kind of terror going on? I said, God, that would suck. That would suck a lot. And I get the chills even thinking about it now. And all of a sudden, just that moment that I could separate myself from that fear and resentment and move into compassion ended up being the game changer for me. And I was able to be present for myself in this case, and that's what needed to happen. And, you know, one of the things it says in the 12 and 12 in the third step is that our whole problem had been the misuse of willpower. And what I realize is that, you know, the one thing that I have to always contend with is my thinking and really just what the disease wants to feed me about a situation. And I look at it as that I do hand-to-hand combat with the disease in my head, and God is the shield and the strength. And it's my job, like if I was walking down an alley and somebody jumped me and it's trying to kill me, am I just going to, you know, fight and knock him down and just be like, okay, he's done. If he gets back up, am I not going to continue to fight? You better believe I am. And I knock him down and I get up. I knock him down and I get up. And that's exactly what dealing with disease thinking is for me. And I've done it enough that somebody notices that I have serenity, even at a dentist. You know, like, hello, the dentist. And that's taken a lot of work and a lot of discipline. And that's, you know, one of the things, you know, like professional athletes do a lot of, you know, visualization and things. And that's essentially what my 10th step turns out to be, you know, in the evening, you know, when I lay in bed. And if something, you know, comes to my mind, I'm like, what could I have done differently? Because it's not like I lay in bed and go, yeah, and then I would have said this, and then I would have said that. And, you know, it's not like that, okay? I was like, if A plus B equals C and C is an undesirable result, change the equation. I started to get elevated. Like, I began to learn that I used to be a rager, just like rip your head off, just, you know, just horrible. I mean, just, it was effective. It protected me, helped me get what I needed. And that was really great at a particular time in my life when I didn't have any other skills. But I have skills now that I can utilize. And, you know, one of the things I realized was that first I was feeling irritated and I didn't acknowledge it and I didn't address it. Then I'm feeling frustrated and I don't acknowledge it and I don't address it. Then I'm feeling angry and I don't acknowledge it and I don't address it. And then I blow a head gasket and I rage all over somebody. And so then I'm laying in bed and I go, okay, so when was I starting to feel irritated or frustrated? Like trying to look back and realize where my personal cues were with that kind of stuff. And I was like, ah. You know, and what I've learned and sort of my exit strategy in conversations is if it's becoming more important for me to be right than to listen to what you have to say, I have no business participating in that conversation. And that's exactly what I say. You know what? It's becoming more important for me to be right than to listen to what you have to say. And it's really important that I be able to listen to what you have to say. So I have to step back and stop this conversation right now. And then I turn around and walk away. And if they still keep talking about me, I said, I'm doing this because I don't want to damage you and I don't want to damage me. And I just walk away. And And that has been extremely effective. You know, I went through a divorce, and I can tell you, through that entire time, never yelled once. Not once. Didn't yell once. We didn't even have to use attorneys when we got divorced. We went and filed together. And he was also in the program, so that helps too. So, but, you know, ultimately, I think the emotional nurturing, that emotional sobriety and stuff that we get the longer that we're here, but the more we do the work. You know, for me, I was talking about this before the meeting. I had shared this at another meeting, but, you know, I used to get, you know, when I get really overwhelmed, and even like when my sister died, you know, one of the like biggest things I know to do on how to soothe myself is that I would get in bed and get in the fetal position, and I pull the covers over, and I imagine that it's God wrapping his arms around me, and God literally like has my back, and I can cry. But I have to be with God when I'm having my feelings. Like, if I'm having a lot of emotions and then the thought goes, this is too much for me, I can't handle this, that is the disease talking. That is not me. That's the disease, because God doesn't give me more than I can handle ever. And so I would say, take a couple deep breaths, and I'd cry. I'm like, I'm safe and I'm protected. And then I'd even ask God, you know, God, what would you say to me right now? And I, you know, God, you know, and then I just sort of like, you know, God would say something to the effect of, you know, you're safe and you're protected. And even on your worst day, I'm proud of you. Even on your worst day, you could never let me down. And I know it feels like a lot, but there are lessons here for you. And let's try to find those. And just get this out of your system, because you always feel better after you cry. And, man, I always feel better after I cry. I've never gained 5 pounds crying. It's not trying to cry that I will gain 5 pounds. It's absolutely irritating. And so if those food stuff starts, I'm like, what's going on with me? That's actually a cue for me to go, like, what's happening with me right now? And, you know, managing, you know, I have a, you know, pretty significant, you know, health condition that I deal with my MS. And I can't work right now. And, you know, I had to... I rested all day long so that I would have the energy to come talk to you today, because I can't go and do a whole bunch of stuff and think that I'm going to have anything in my tank, because I just don't have the stamina. And I was happy to do that, happy to be able to come and be of service and talk. And actually, one of the times that I feel most connected to God is when I share. Because I'm not thinking about what I'm trying to say. I really have a desire to just carry a message. And if even one person can get something out of it, like, mission accomplished, you know. And, you know, faith without works is dead. You know, work. You know, I thought that this whole concept of faith when I got sober, it was literally, I thought in order for me to be able to have any kind of connection with God, I would be like floating on a magic carpet. It was that out of my realm. And, you know, I actually had gone, when I had 90 days of sobriety, I went and spoke to a priest. I had gone to Catholic school for 5 years, and I went and talked to a priest, and I honestly don't remember what I said. I mean, I told him, like, look, I feel like I have to be sober. I'm dying, and I know I need to have a higher power, and I don't think I can do it the Catholic way. And I don't know what to do about that. And I don't remember what he said. We spoke for an hour, but when I left, I felt like I had permission to find God any way that I needed to, so that I could just be with God. He's basically, all paths lead the same way. Doesn't matter how you get there, just get there. And it's all about doing the work. And so, you know, the really challenging, you know, my disease thinking and talking to other people and sanity checking my thinking and all of that, and just being really, really rigorous about what I'm supposed to be doing, because I can't control anything. Acceptance is the answer to all of my problems today. It really, really is. The one thing that I can control is whether I'm going to find a silver lining in this situation or not. And the silver lining, you know, I used to do this with sponsees, and I still do this if they're being obnoxious. You know, they call me, and every time I'm like, you know, how about this? Nah, I got 12 reasons why they can't do it. And, you know, I'm just like, you know, and another suggestion and another suggestion. I'm like, all right, gun to your head. You have 3 seconds to find a silver lining in the situation, or I'm killing you. Magically, they can find a solution. They can find that silver lining. And sometimes I have to really do that to myself. Like, I imagine somebody's going to shoot my mom. And, Mom, I literally do this. This is the mental gymnastics that I do. Like, somebody's got a gun to my, you know, the disease has a gun to my mom's head. And I'm like, okay, fine. You know, and that's what I had to do with my sister, you know, and finding, you know, the fact that she's no longer suffering. You know, that's, I find a lot of peace in that. And I find she's just giggling at that idea of killing my mother. My poor mom, she has no idea. She's been up on the table, like, she's been on the table many times with me. And, but it's a beautiful gift. You know, the truth is, you know, sometimes I sit in meetings and I listen to people share, and I forget like how crazy my thinking used to be, because I've done this for so long, and I, you know, with the prayer and the meditation and like unconditional surrender to God's will, like no matter what it is, like, oh, I wanted to do that. Well, obviously I wasn't supposed to be doing that. In fact, when things don't go my way, it is proof positive that there is another plan in place, and that rejection is protection for me, even on the most minute little things. And God is always, always looking out for my best interest. And as long as I'm doing, you know, like, what's God's will versus my will, anything that leads me to be happy, healthy, joyous, and free in an unselfish manner, that's God's will for me. That, and I think that that's what God's will is for everyone. You know, I didn't get sober so that I could die of emphysema. I didn't get sober so I could die of a heart attack. I've had to look at, you know, I pray, God be there when I have no mental defense against the first drink, drug, cigarette, food, or fuck. It's the big five for me. That's just the way it goes. And, you know, and I just have to really surrender those things, because all of those things cut me off from God. And every time I've had to go to God to really look at other outside issues, I have been able to get closer to God. My intuition has become so much more clear. My ability to just feel okay in my own skin is amazing. Like, I feel safe and protected all the time. Like, I mean, I had, like, I can think, like, even when my sister died, I mean, in the last, you know, what, 8 months or something like that, I've had one time that I really needed to call my sponsor because I was spinning about something, and it was about money. I mean, I called my sponsor when my sister died because I needed to call my sponsor. It's a major life event. But I got more wrapped around the axle about something about money than I was worried about the fact that my sister had died, because I trust God's will. But in that moment, and I called and I talked to her and I prayed and I reminded myself that I'm safe and I'm protected, and I was free from that. I mean, that's just, I mean, to be able to, I never knew that I wanted this. I never knew that I needed this. And my mom tells me now that when she grows up, she wants to be like me. So thanks.